Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Nancy Judd. She's the founder of Recycle Runway, which is an environmental, what would you call it, an environmental organization that brings attention to recycling.
That sounds good. Yeah.
And has been working in the field of recycling for many years. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Mary Charlotte.
How did you get into the whole world of recycling? You've been doing it since 1980, which was a time where it wasn't even that popular of an idea.
Well, it was kind of a random event, actually, which set it all off for me. I got my Bachelor of Arts from Pitzer College, but during that time, I took a year off and went to art school. And this kind of random thing happened, which is that the school put in a pop machine. And when they did that, the garbage can next to it filled up with aluminum cans. And I grew up in Oregon, and so grew up as a little bottle bill child, and collected cans every week and took them to the store. And so it just bothered me enough that I asked the school if I could set up a little recycling program for them, and they said yes. And so I got the bin, but then you know, somebody had to pick up the bin, and I got really curious about what happened to the material and what was it made into, and the whole infrastructure of recycling became really interesting to me. So when I returned to Pitzer College to finish up my degree in actually sociology and art, I did an independent study in solid waste management and recycling, and that launched a career for me.
So one of the things about recycling that I always wonder about is, where do the cans go? I guess you know this. Where do the bottles go? Where do the little plastic things that we eat out of go?
Well, there's about 20 different answers to those three questions, and it all depends upon where you live. In Santa Fe, it all goes to the recycling center, and then it gets crushed and put on trucks and then taken to different parts of the country. Cans are usually actually recycled into new aluminum cans and will end up back on the shelf within about a month's period of time.
Is that right? That's fast turnaround.
Yeah, it is. It's one of our most efficient recycling materials and procedures that we have in place right now.
Actually, I was reading about cans and the incredible savings in energy and materials when you recycle versus when you try to get new aluminum out of the ground.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely
the case. It's like a 95% savings.
Yeah. And reduction in energy costs and use of water. So that's a really significant one for sure.
What about glass?
Glass in Santa Fe is taken to our transfer station, and they have a crusher. And so it gets pulverized and made into little tiny chips, and then it's used for different projects. Sometimes landscapers will come and get it and use it either for backfill, or will use it for, you know, like to make a little river, you know, of glass within a landscape project. Also, it can be used like up in Taos. They mix it with salt and they put it on the roads in the winter to help de-ice the roads.
When it's pulverized, it's not dangerous?
No, it's not. In fact, one of my dresses, the glass evening gown, is made out of little pieces of clear glass, 12,000 pieces of clear glass about the size of a fingernail that were glued to a dress I made. And so that took me about 400 hours to make that dress. And not once in that whole process was I ever cut. Because in the process of being crushed, the glass is slightly tumbled.
So the raw edges get like sea glass.
Exactly. Exactly.
Out.
Yeah.
Very interesting. In the old days, the milkman would leave a bottle of milk, you'd drink it, and then the bottle would be reused. Do we still have any of that?
Well, I think some of the boutique dairies may do that.
But I mean, with soda bottles, beer bottles, any of that?
Not in this country. Not very much, unfortunately, which is too bad because, you know, recycling is is really important, and we need to do it. However, we really need to reduce our resources, more importantly. And so,
when you say reduce our resources, what do you
by
mean?
By making new items. So by making like one-use containers such as glass bottles or plastic bottles that water come in that are used for, you know, maybe 10 minutes and then thrown away, as opposed to making a bottle that can be reused over and over again, that is really preferable to those one-use items because we aren't having to create all the resources to make the item and then it takes a lot of resources to recycle. If at best it's being recycled or if at worst it's going to the landfill, then it sits there for, you know, 100 years before it will fall apart.
And in plastic, it's a lot longer than 100 years.
Right. Yeah.
So why don't we reuse bottles?
Well, again, it's an infrastructure issue. And I think it's perceived as a safety issue as well. In terms of like glass bottles used to be recycled more, but then like if there's a little chip or something and then somebody gets cut and sued. And so,
right.
I think it's also sort of the way that our society has become in terms of, convenience. It's just easier to take it, use it, throw it, you know, away in a can. And there's just more planning, that needs to go on with reuse like that.
Now, what about plastic? There was an amazing book called The World Without Us that has a chapter about what would happen if human beings were to vanish off the face of the earth. And one of the things that would remain for a very long time is plastic.
Yeah. Yeah, boy, that's a tough one. Let's just start talking about it in terms of recycling. Plastic is pretty complicated. In the city of Santa Fe, we're only able to recycle plastic number one and number two bottles. And what that means is if you turn a plastic container upside down, look on the bottom, you'll see three arrows, and in the middle of the arrow is a number. And that number refers to the type of plastic, which it is, and that it's made out of. And so we only recycle number one and two plastics. But only one and two plastics that are in the shape of a bottle. So if the neck is smaller than the base, then we can recycle it. However, things like yogurt containers might have a number two on the bottom, but we aren't able to recycle them because the reason being is that plastic is so complicated to recycle. If you take like a number two, on the bottom of a yogurt container, you'll see a number two. Another example of a number two plastic would be detergent bottles. So if you think about those two plastics, the yogurt container is much thinner than the detergent bottle, right? So if you put them together and recycle them, and what happens when they recycle them is they melt the plastic to create a new product. And so the yogurt container will melt first before the detergent bottle will. And by the time the detergent bottle melts, the yogurt container plastic will have burned. So they have to actually be processed separately.
And the city isn't willing to separate them?
One thing is that it's all dependent upon markets. And so currently there are really strong markets for number one and number two bottles for those types of plastic. And there are fewer markets for the other types of plastics. So one issue is, can they find a market for it? The other is really a space issue because, to make a bale of plastic, you have to have like a couple of, you know, large rooms full of just plastic bottles because they're all air, right?
Right.
And if right now, actually, with the recycling of number one and number two bottles, it has to be sorted into three different categories. Just those two commodities do. So that takes up a certain amount of space just to be able to save up enough bottles of those three different kinds to make it.
Good heavens.
It's very complicated.
So what is the market for recycled plastic bales?
Plastic gets made into things such as, the most common one actually that we see in Santa Fe is playground equipment. It can also be made into parking stops, plastic lumber, into new fleece material, like for, for fleece jackets and such.
And that's very interesting. So your laundry detergent bottle, you might get back later as a pink fleece shirt.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And so when we put in our, because I didn't even know that till you just said it right now, I always recycle number one and two, including yogurt containers. So my number two yogurt containers go dutifully into my bin and then go into the landfill?
Yeah, I hate to break it to you, but that's what happens is they get sorted out at the transfer station or at the recycling center, and they do get thrown away.
So we're talking to Nancy Judd, Recycle Runway, and you were starting to allude to your fashion. The runway is all about not only, you know, aftermarket bales of plastic, but actually this incredible clothing that you make out of recycled materials. How did you get into that? You're a self-taught seamstress.
Well, I used to be the recycling coordinator for the city of Santa Fe, and I got together with some other people in the community, and we started a public education event called the Recycle Santa Fe Art Market. And it's a weekend-long event where artists who use found objects and recycled materials come out and get to sell their wares. And so we kick off the event on the opening night with a trash fashion contest. And this year will actually be our 10th year of this event, the 10th year anniversary. It's going to be in November at El Museo. And the first year we had it, I made a dress just to promote the show for the fun of it. And the next year I made another one, and the next year another. And they just became more and more elaborate. And then I had this collection of the pieces I had made and then garments that, people who'd been in the shows gave to me that they didn't want anymore. And so my peers in the recycling world around the country found out about this collection I had and started to invite me to bring it to their communities and put on recycled fashion shows. And so that's kind of how it all started.
You're going to be teaching a recycled fashion workshop for adults toward the end of this month, and in September and October, and also something for teens. This is obviously a fun and symbolic thing rather than a way to actually make a dent in the mountains and mountains of materials. But what I'm amazed by is how, these things could be on a real runway in Paris. I mean, they're just incredibly beautiful and glamorous.
Thank you very much. That's what I'm going for. My intent is really to use the garments as a way to draw people in a creative, fun, playful exhibit to capture their attention and then to start a conversation of sorts about recycling and about broader environmental issues. And so the way I do this is that I put on exhibits in really high traffic areas across the country, particularly in airports. So my first exhibit was at the Albuquerque Sunport, and it was last fall. And right now I have an exhibit up at the Pittsburgh International Airport, which is up in from August through December. And my next exhibit after that is going to be in the Atlanta International Airport, which is particularly exciting to me because it's the largest airport in the world. They're giving me 9 full-size cases, so I'll be displaying 20 of my garments. And it's all throughout Concourse E, the international concourse, and 38,000 people a day walk through that concourse, and it'll be up for a year.
Is it possible for you to get feedback? I mean, there's so many people walking by each day, but do you know what they think and if they actually stop and look?
Yeah, well, we spend time with the exhibits when I'm there and when I can, and talking to people and getting their input and what attracted them to the exhibit, what is the message they got out of it. And so as I do each new exhibit, I get more and more information. And really, you know, my ultimate goal is to inspire and encourage people to take a look at their lives, take a look at their carbon footprint, and to find ways, and I help, you know, I give suggestions of things that we can do in our lives to help conserve resources and reduce pollution.
What are some of those things? I mean, I eat yogurt. And the yogurt stuff goes in the landfill. I mean, short of actually having your own farm and bringing everything in glass containers straight from the cow to your kitchen. How do you really reduce your footprint, especially in these materials, some of which don't even get recycled?
Well, there's lots of different ways. If everybody could just use the recycling program we had for the materials that are generated, that alone would be really significant. So that's one thing. There's infrastructural things that need to happen so that your yogurt container can be recycled. And recycling is really important. But going back to what I said before, it's really about conservation and reducing our consumption where we can.
And where can we? That's the question.
Yeah, so where can we exactly? There's lots of things that we can reuse in our lives. You think about when we go to the store and we buy a book and they put it in a plastic bag, right? So do we really need that bag in the first place? We're going to use it for how long? Maybe an hour, and then we're done with it. So not using a bag, putting it in your purse, bringing bags with you. Like, there's an example of something that we could do. And we may not really realize the resources it took to get that bag in our hand. You know, the materials that had to be mined to create it, all of the trucks that had to be used, and all the gas they used, the exhaust that they created just to get it to be processed, to get to where we were going, the electricity from all the buildings, just for this little bag that was in our hand for, you know, 10 to 30 minutes, whatever the case.
Right.
But then there's other really easy things. Like, you think about the consumption of electricity from electronics when we aren't even using them. How many of us actually turn off all the electronics at night or when we leave the house? And you think about that multiplied by all of the homes, multiplied by all the workplaces. How about all the workplaces that turn off their lights at the end of the day? You know, one of the things Al Gore encouraged people to do was to put all their electronics on a strip so that all you'd have to do is turn off your computer and then turn off the strip. Because we often don't realize that our electronics are drawing electricity even when they're off.
Right. You also work a bit with children.
That's right. In addition to the education that happens from the exhibits themselves, I feel like it's really important to do hands-on grassroots education with kids. And so I have presentations that I do in schools, boys and girls clubs, all over, and in which I talk to kids about the issues we've been talking about their individual impact and their individual power and how they can make a difference at home, at school. And we talk about the resources that are used just to make something simple like junk mail. And they really get the point and they ask really great questions like, well, what happens to all the animals in the forest when we cut down the trees to make junk mail? And one of the things that's really fun that I've started doing is having the kids help me to make a new dress that I've designed. And so at the end of the presentation, after we've talked about all the things that they can do in their lives to help conserve resources, I ask them to, when I first get to the site or the school, I ask the teacher for a couple pieces of recycled office paper. And I take that paper and I cut it into strips. And then at the end of the presentation, I ask the kids to write on a strip of paper their name and what their commitment is to the environment. And what I'm going to do with all those strips of paper is take them and make them into paper link chains. And then I'm going to take those chains and I'm going to attach them to a big, white, fluffy Scarlett O'Hare style dress.
Oh, great.
And so this dress will represent our youth's commitment to the environment. So I'm in talking with kids, I am really trying to get them to be active in terms of their role of being a steward of the environment and to encourage their parents and their teachers as well. And then also involving them in my design and creation of garments. That dress will be on display at the Atlanta airport for a year next year.
Nancy, if people want to get in touch with you and find out more about your workshops and your work, how do they do so?
There's two ways. My telephone number is 505-983-7048. They can also reach me via email at Nancy, that's N-A-N-C-Y, @recycleRunway.com.
Nancy Judd, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
I'd like to introduce Tim Stepetic. He is the operations director for the Office of the New Mexico State Medical Investigator, and he is giving a talk at the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers titled Autopsy Investigation 1.01 and the CSI Effect, and that is Wednesday. That's actually tonight, September 10th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Annex at 123 Grant Avenue. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Happy to be here.
So this is, I guess in the old days, it was called the Office of the Coroner. What's the difference between the old county coroner system and the state medical investigator?
Well, a medical investigator, or sometimes also an examiner system, is an advancement over a coroner system. A coroner system was probably the original system we had in this country. It came over from England. And the coroner is generally a political appointee, or he may even be an elected office. But it's rare that he would be a forensic pathologist, and quite frequently he may not even be a doctor. And what that does is it puts death investigation somewhat into a political arena, and it shouldn't be. I think the states, which are probably about two-thirds of the states right now that have taken on an investigator or an examiner system, have built a system which is much more objective in their determinations of cause and manner of death.
So basically, your office is about receiving people who have died and figuring out how and why they died?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Our statutory charter from the state asks that we investigate deaths that are suspicious, unusual, drug or alcohol caused, possibly medically related, environmentally related, possibly resulting from infectious disease, all cases of which the person is in custody.
And so what kind of cases do you get on a regular basis?
Well, numerically, just as a point of interest, in any recent year, about 14,000 people die in the state of New Mexico, and under those guidelines from the state, we would look at about 5,000 of those deaths.
That's a pretty high percentage.
It is a high percentage. We do better than most states considerably. Actually, our autopsy rate, which would be about 2,000, say, out of 14,000, is about a 15% rate. And I think the rest of the state, somewhere it might be around 10 or 11, may be the average. So yeah, I think it's a reflection on a very good, very comprehensive death investigation system.
So what are some of the actual types of cases you get? So you get a lot of drugs and alcohol. Do they get referred to you from the police?
Yes, from the police, from the hospitals, from the EMTs, people that respond to these cases. And the numbers of drug-related deaths have jumped considerably in the last couple years, from like the middle 300s for some period of time up into 2 years ago about 410, and last year I believe the number was 444 drug-related deaths.
And so we're talking about what kinds of drugs?
Well, we're talking about illicit drugs, heroin and cocaine, and then we're talking about a growing number of prescriptive drug deaths, which would be, you know, mainly hydrocodone, oxycontin, these types of cases.
Do you get put in the position of determining whether it was a suicide or an overdose?
A suicide or an accident? Yes, we do. Most of the times we will consider it an accident unless there is compelling evidence such as a history, suicidal ideations, perhaps a note that it was a suicide death. I would say maybe out of 440 or so deaths, maybe 350 would be accident, maybe 100 would be suicide.
In your position, do you have any insights that the rest of us might not have into what's going on, why the number of drug-related deaths, for example, has jumped?
I don't know, Mary Charlotte, that we have particular insights. We work a lot with the local law enforcement, state, DEA, different federal agencies on this. It would seem that it's, you know, the nature of life in New Mexico. We're on a couple major traffic routes for drugs. You know, we're a poor state. I would think poverty and living conditions sometimes is going to enhance the use of drugs, you know, in particular localities. Stresses of life these days. I don't know. I guess there's a lot of conjecture floating around. I don't know if we're in any better position, just having seen these deaths, you know, to really make too much of a statement there.
It must be in some ways, I mean, I suppose you're used to it because you've been doing it for a long time, but to be in a work situation where your business is dead bodies. I mean, you never see these people when they're alive. What's it actually like to work in that environment?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, it gets to you. It really does. We have one portion of our staff that really no other office in the country has, and that is we have a grief counseling staff. And so we have five professional master's degree social workers who specialize in grief counseling on our immediate staff. And they came on board in the early 80s strictly to work with families, and that is still their primary job, but they work with us a lot, and they keep us on a pretty good emotional footing, I think, most of the time. But it does. You just sometimes you fall into some pretty depressive spirals just because of what you see and, you know, how you kind of relate some of these deaths to your personal life and your own family. So, it is with a considerable degree of difficulty that you stay working there, yeah.
I would think especially if you see young people coming through.
Yes, young people, babies. We probably see, you know, one or two babies every week. And young people, you know, I mean, I have a couple daughters. They're 20 and 22. And at that age, when you really worry about them, and it seems like every week we see a young person in there, you know, a car accident, an overdose, perhaps shot by a boyfriend, you know, some other form of suicide. It makes it tough.
So when you have, for example, a body that came in that's unidentified, where do you start? What do you do to determine the cause of death?
Well, the first, we kind of run through a hierarchy of activities. The first thing we'll do is really look at the scene very closely to see what kind of evidence is at the scene, including people that may have witnessed the death or people that may know something, you know, where we can locate members of the family or something. If we don't have this, the first thing we're going to turn to is fingerprints. If fingerprints aren't obtainable or we get no results from fingerprints, we'll go to dental x-rays. But then with dental x-rays, we kind of need to have an idea who the person might be, because there's really no dental x-ray database like there is a fingerprint database. Possibly full body x-rays, we may go to that, but again, we need to have an idea who the person might be. And I think our final activity would be DNA. And DNA is, you know, it's expensive and it takes time, but, you know, those, we would pursue DNA in cases like this also. We probably have about 330 ID-type DNA cases pending with the FBI right now.
So when you say they're pending with the FBI, does that mean necessarily that there is a crime involved?
No. Where there is a crime involved, we will work with the state and local DNA offices. If it's non-criminal, if it's ID only, the DNA provides us, or the FBI provides us the DNA service for free.
So let's talk about the crime scene. And, of course, a lot of people watch crime shows on TV. I know I do. In real life, when you go to a crime scene, describe a couple of typical crime scenes and what you do there.
Well, when we are called to a crime scene, we're generally called by the law enforcement agency. The law enforcement agency is there. They set up their investigation of the crime scene, and they will hold an investigational briefing right shortly after the crime is discovered. We will go to that briefing. We will learn what the situation is, how long the police need for their investigation, and then we come back later and we do our investigation of the body, and then we retrieve the body. Actually, the law enforcement agency owns the crime scene, and OMI owns the body. So in their investigation of the local scene, the local law enforcement should really not even be touching the body. But then we wait for them to be complete, and then we go in and do our thing and then retrieve the body and bring it back to OMI.
What are the similarities and the differences between what you do and what we see on television?
Well, what you see on television in actuality is accomplished by a lot of different agencies. You know, it's not the same five or so people, you know, in their Armani and their Versace and their Silver Hummers, you know, doing this thing. I mean, it's law enforcement basically investigates the crime scene, retrieves evidence from the crime scene. Their evidence goes to the crime laboratory. We retrieve the body. We do the autopsy. Some of our evidence will go to the crime laboratory. Others' activities that we do will go to toxicology and chemistry labs. If we need consultant work from an anthropologist, an odontologist, an entomologist, we call these people in. We generally have an anthropologist on our staff, but odontology and entomology work would be contract work. So it's not like five people do it all, and I think that's the impression you get from CSI and some of the other TV shows.
We're talking to Tim Stepetic. He is the operations director for the Office of the New Mexico State Medical Investigator. What does the anthropologist do?
Well, when we have skeletal remain cases, and we have maybe 50 or 60 of those a year, and the anthropologist is trained in telling, you know, at least coming up with ethnicity of the body, the description of the height, the bone formation of the person. Maybe the anthropologist can find something that might, you know, give us indications toward cause of death, finding cracked bones or nicks or things like this. They're very helpful. And also in other cases, just they're very helpful with identification.
When you think of anthropologists, you think of people who study the living. How does it translate?
Well, this is a specific field called forensic anthropology, and they are working mainly with skeletal remains. They can tell if the remains are ancient, you know, under which case they get turned over to the state historical preservation officer, or if they're more recent, then we will take them on as an investigative case. The anthropologist that we had for a couple years, Dr. Komar, Debbie Komar, was quite prominent in the United States and also internationally. And we, you know, may have made a mistake by releasing her to do some work in Darfur and Iraq. And earlier than that, she worked in Bosnia on mass excavation of graves. And she left us in June to take a full-time job with the International Court in The Hague in the Netherlands and to provide testimony on this type of work that she had done.
Now, do you ever have, I mean, you alluded when you say ancient remains, somebody finding a body and it turns out to be thousands of years old?
Well, ancient in our definition is, it can be anywhere. I've heard it differently, 50 years or 100 years old. And in most cases, these would probably be Native American remains. I don't know that we found anything, you know, thousands of years in New Mexico.
What does the entomologist do?
Oh, the entomologist, you know, the study of insects. And maybe one or two times a year, we will use insects to determine time of death. You know, they go through the larvae, the pupa, that process to find out exactly when the person may have died. Most often it's not that awfully important, but also we'll give you an idea of indigenous insects on the body as to whether the body has been moved from another location, just to gather more clues about the death.
Do you have a lot of cases of people who die of, for example, spider bites?
I would say we have probably two or three a year, and it may be cases where a spider bite may turn into a case of necrotizing fasciitis. Sure. So we will see some of those.
And when you say you you said a moment ago that you can tell whether the body has been moved by entomological studies, what do you mean by that?
Well, if our normal way to tell if a body is moved is the livor mortis pattern, the way the blood settles at the bottom of the body and just forms a pattern just because gravity drops it down there. And we can tell if the pattern is not consistent with the way the body is found, then we know the body has been moved. When we use an entomologist, we're looking for movement probably from a different county or a different part of the state where insects will reside where the person was originally, and we will find them in a place where they're not a native species to where the body was found.
So there are, for example, what kind of insect? There'd be an insect that's only native to southern New Mexico that wouldn't be found in northern?
Absolutely, absolutely. I don't know the names of any of those insects, but I'm absolutely sure that that's the case.
Okay. When, for example, you have a case where there's not a death certificate and the family doesn't want their family member to have an autopsy, do they have a choice about it?
Oh, not really. If the case is compelling enough to do it, if it's an autopsy, if it's a criminal case, we will just absolutely have to do an autopsy. If it's an unknown death that is probably not criminal, we will talk to the family. And most families don't want an autopsy right off the bat, but when they talk to our doctors, investigators, grief counselors, you know, I think they see the benefit of the autopsy and they will generally agree to it. If they're adamant about not wanting an autopsy, we will try to find another way to make a determination as to cause and manner of death through, you know, a less invasive means. And that may be full body X-ray, just a meticulous review of medical records, things like that. If we cannot agree with the family, we give them the option to go to court and to get a court order showing why we should not do an autopsy. And I've been at OMI for 10 years, and that has never happened. We've always achieved resolution before we've gotten to that point.
How has the technology changed, and how has it improved in helping you do your work?
Well, the technology is always moving forward. The chemistry tests for the different drugs are advancing. A lot of information is going digital. Our photography is going digital. We're trying to work our way into digital radiography also. I think there are a lot of things coming along. DNA has been a major thing in, crime scene investigation, death investigation, identification, things like that. Another aspect that's coming into play is radiology, and that would be CT scanning and MRIs and things like that. It may ultimately let us do an autopsy or let us do an investigation in a completely non-invasive manner. We will be moving into a new building in about less than 2 years now, and we hope to have a CT scan and an MRI in that new building, and we may see that it's certainly going to tell us more than we are able to learn now, autopsy-wise. And, you know, down the road, it may even allow us to do fewer autopsies and more radiological investigations.
Again, I mean, because my model, and probably almost everybody hearing this model of what a medical examiner does is crime shows. Do you have, on a fairly regular basis, or you know, in the course of a given year, mysteries that you are able to solve through your technology, through your work?
Well, we have. I would say there's a lot of cases that come in that might be of more of a natural case where we were able to find out, you know, exactly what happened from a disease standpoint, things like that. That seems to be what happens the most. We certainly help solve crimes, but I think most of that is through testimony of the doctors verifying, you know, a weapon or verifying the effects of a weapon in court. We've had some unusual cases where I think the standard procedures that we've put into place have helped us, you know, find things that are somewhat out of the ordinary, yes.
Can you think of any examples of that?
Oh, I'm thinking of a case probably, this happened several years ago when a young man came in from Farmington, and he was working on a drill rig, I think, up there, and keeled over with no obvious cause. And it turned out when he came into us, we could not see anything either. But when we did the X-rays, we found a small missile or a small steel object in his back, and it turned out that it actually came off of the sledgehammer that he was using to pound in a steak, and a piece of the sledgehammer came off and just went right to his heart and turned, you know, as it was going, and it pretty much opened up his heart, and he bled out internally. But the small piece of metal went in on its edge and barely even made a mark on his chest, and you know, it explained what happened, and it was just a very, very unusual case. We retrieved the sledgehammer and were able to see exactly where the metal came off the sledgehammer.
That's quite amazing. People are, for good reason, concerned about environmental toxins. What do you see? Do you see people who have... Is it possible for you to see the kinds of toxins in our environment that kill people?
You know, the testing in the laboratories has gotten quite sophisticated. When we are supported by the state laboratory, whom we share the building with, that really has great techniques and great people and can get into a lot of different areas as far as the study of, like, volatiles, things like this. I really can't latch on to a specific case right now. I'm trying to think. Certainly when we investigate fire deaths, you know, when we're looking at a comparison to try to make a determination whether the person died from thermal injuries or from the ingestion of toxic chemicals, you know, plastics and things like this that are consumed by the fire, and this the laboratory is able to do that for us fairly easily. So, but generally, general environmental conditions, I can't think of a specific case, Mary Charlotte, where one of those has taken place.
We're talking to Tim Stepetic with the Office of the New Mexico State Medical Investigator. So do young people want to go into this field? What I know you go and talk to high school kids, you make presentations to the public. Are they interested in getting into the kind of work that you do?
Well, it sure seems to be. And if they're not interested in particularly forensic medicine, they're interested in, you know, just about forensics, anything, investigations of, well, they're interested in laboratory work, they're interested in crime scene investigations, they're interested in writing. I think it's a great interest, and I'm quite surprised what's happened in New Mexico over the last 10 years or so, the amount of forensic science classes that are going on in high schools in New Mexico. There's a ton of them. And I think that definitely reflects the children's demands for what they want to learn in high school and, you know, their receptivity to this type of information. So I'm hoping it's going to continue. And actually, we need more forensic pathologists in the country. We might have about 480 or 500 jobs out there, and we've probably only got 400 or so practicing forensic pathologists. So we need to get some of these young students into the pipeline to, you know, take up the slack here.
What kind of training do you have to go through to be a forensic pathologist?
Well, you know, when they find that out, it's kind of discouraging because it's a long haul. It would be 4 years of pre-med work in college after high school, and that would be followed by 4 years of medical school, and then that in turn is followed by 4 years of residency, a pathology residency that you would have to go through. And then there will be a final year of a forensic pathology fellowship. So, and then some doctors will also do a forensic neuropathology fellowship. So it could be 13 or 14 years after high school. So the training's very extensive.
Why do so few people, I mean, 400 in the whole country, go into that line of work? Is it just because it's morbid and depressing?
Well, you know, it's not so much in the medical forefront, you know, although a lot of aspects of it should be because of what the information that comes out of ME offices. But I don't know, perhaps it's just not appealing to a lot of people. Maybe the investigational motivation is just not out there. I don't think money should be a deterrent. I think the forensic pathologists make pretty good money. I don't know. I would look to see more people doing forensic pathology.
What will you be talking about in tonight's Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers?
Well, I think I'll cover a lot of what we discussed today. I like to talk about the office, how it came into being, why we do what we do, and how we do it. I like to go through the docket of the day's cases, so I'll have the cases that we're handling today, and I'll go through those in some detail as to why these people came to our office and what we expect to find and what techniques we are going to use. I have a 35-minute video of an autopsy, which is extremely well done. It fully explains the autopsy process. And then I have a couple little PowerPoint presentations, which are called Factor Crap, which is kind of fun because it goes through some CSI scenes, and then we talk about the technology that's employed in those scenes. And I will ask the group, you know, well, okay, this happened here. You saw this. You think this is fact, or you think it's just a you know, example of Hollywood crap? And so we will go through that. And it's a fun presentation.
Tim Stupetic, anything else that you want to let our listeners know before we go?
No, other than we have a great office. We've got one of the best in the country. And please, you know, call us and find us out. Find out what you can about us. And I'm looking forward to this evening.
The office of the New Mexico State Medical Investigator can be found at omi.unm.edu. That means you're affiliated with the University of New Mexico?
Yes, Mary Charlotte. We're actually administered by the university. We're part of the School of Medicine and the Department of Pathology.
Well, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Okay, thank you, Mary Charlotte. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. Tim Stupetic is Operations Director for the Office of the New Mexico State Medical Investigator, and he will be speaking tonight at the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers in a presentation titled Autopsy Investigation 1.01, the CSI Effect, and that's from 6 to 8 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Educational Annex at 123 Grant Avenue in Santa Fe. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.